I think we should do the shot put and the sponge ball because they're two totally different weights. And if you drop them at the same time, maybe they'll drop at the same speed.
Drop.
So every class that has about 30 kids in it has one Galileo. This one was a little girl. Cut right to, she realized, nobody can click on and click off the stopwatch accurately enough because we don't know when the janitor is dropping the thing. So why not just drop them in pairs and listen for the result, which is basically what Galileo did. So the real way to understand what's going on here is to use a consumer video camera and just video what's going on. Even that's difficult to see. But because this is a dynamic media system with a uniform object model, we can just pull frames out of the movie, and so we can stack every fifth frame side by side, for example. We can stack them up vertically like that. And what the kids do is they start measuring from the bottom of the ball on one frame to the bottom of the ball on the next frame by just stretching these rectangles here. Like that, and then if you just stack these guys, so the heights of the rectangles are actually the measure of the velocity. And this looks like the velocity is changing by roughly a constant amount. And a little script for our simulated ball here says, let's take a variable called speed and increase it by -5 each time. So that's our constant acceleration. And then let's change the ball's position, vertical position, by that speed each time. And by the way, let's try playing it against, I'm going to stop right there and let Tyrone tell you what he did.
And to make sure that I was doing it just right, I got a magnifier, which would help me figure out if the size was just right. After I'd done that, I would go and click on the little basic category button, and then a little menu would pop up, and one of the categories would be geometry, so I click on that. And here it has many things that have to do with the size and shape of the rectangle. So I would see that the height, and I kept going along the process until I had them all lined up with their height. I subtracted the smaller one's height from the big one to see if there was a kind of pattern anywhere that could help me and my business worked. So, in order to show that it was working, I decided to move a dot copy so that it would show.
So it drops little cookies.
The exact right speed and acceleration.
To show it matches up with the video taken of the real ball. Here's another one where we run the simulation and the movie together, which is kind of fun. So by the way, this understanding how this works is something that 70% of college students never get through successfully. So this is a good example of how point of view is worth 80 IQ points. Changing the context, changing the math, changing the way it's thought about, changing the way you make models has an incredible difference as to what you can do. We can thank Seymour Papert for many of these insights. Once you've captured gravity, you can put it on interesting objects, like a spaceship. And so you really want a motor. So gravity is a velocity eater, a motor is a velocity producer. This little script makes a flame when the motor is on, and this is the one that crashes you if you're landing too quickly. So you see, I can toss the ship up here. Land it carefully. And you can go much further than that. So here's a little spaceship from Space War game, And I can get another one by just copying it here. Just trying to show you what these programs look like. This is the thing for Space War right there. Put these ships in here. Let's change the color of this one. Let's turn them on. This is kind of what we were thinking about. Stuart should find this interesting because this is a theme that he and I have been talking about for many, many, many years. Okay, let's shift gears to something a little more biological, which is feedback. Here's a little script I think you can all... It's fun doing this with programmers in the room because I don't have to explain this. Just read it. So the goal here was to make a car, a little robot car that would stay in the middle of the road. And this is the result, the solution of these two 11-year-old girls. So the idea is only go forward when you're sensing the blue color. Notice it stopped when it hit one of the curbs. Turn one way or the other when you hit either of the curbs. So it can negotiate any turn. They realized that if they drew the road poorly and all of these things were firing off, it would still work because the plus four and the minus four would cancel each other out. So this is a beautiful little solution. This is done by these kids after about 6 weeks of one day a week learning this stuff. It's quite shocking to see what children can do. So here's how you do animation. You make a bunch of drawings, drop them into the holder. The little program is holder's cursor increases by one. What if I increase it by two? What if I increase it by 0.5? You've learned about rates and sampling. And then we're changing the costume of the ball. And if you combine that with the feedback and look at brightness, then you can do a salmon swimming upstream. So the salmon is trying to find the darker water, which represents a higher concentration of the perfume. And when it loses it, it's circling to find it. So it's chugging along here. And the clownfish uses the very same technique to follow the circular gradient given off by the sea anemone that it acclimates to. And if you take that idea and put it in the micro scale with a particle system like Star Logo, this is called Star Squeak, you can do ants. So we have 10,000 patches underneath here that are all computing simultaneously to do the diffusion of the pheromones given off by the individual ants when they find the food. And when an ant wanders into the gradient and it doesn't have food, it goes upstream to find the food. And once it has food, it follows another gradient to find the next. This is a wonderful thing for teaching children about systems. And I wish executives would understand it a little more also. Because you can see how simple local organizing principles can organize almost the entire system without requiring any direct communications. This is a loose coupling model. And there are more important things that children can learn about. For instance, they can learn about epidemics, such as the SARS thing or AIDS. This is a little two-line program here. And these are just like the little cars infecting each other. Here's the survivor. But it's never been the case. So most infections that act slowly, have a very slow start, are not nearly as exciting as some of the other things. Okay, now we're about ready for our experimental software. And this is pre-alpha stuff we're going to show you, so this might be a little more exciting.
We're not.
But David has been having some heating problems on his machine.
Have we switched already?
I'll switch. So I'm over on that one, and David.
Casey, you're there?
Yeah, you're there.
Awesome.
So should we try connecting?
Just a second.
So what this is a... is a kind of a next layer on the internet. One of our colleagues is Dave Reed, who's the slash and DCB slash IP. So he's another. It's a good way of saying, because he was instrumental in the separation out of those two ideas that are so useful today. And the basic idea here is that the internet itself was designed to solve an N-squared problem, which is how to do point-to-point communication without having a crossbar switch. So it's done using peer-to-peer. When it was done in the late 60s and 70s, it was realized that it was going to make Engelbart's immersive stuff really, really difficult. Because Engelbart's stuff, collaboration was done through a server, and there are unfortunately 2 to the n possible subgroups in a network of n people. So this is not a scalable idea. It's much less scalable than N squared. And so Dave Reed and other people started thinking about how could you do this 2 to the n problem as a completely peer-to-peer, non-server way of doing things. And so let's see if the demo gods are with us, David.
Okay. I'm definitely over there?
Yeah.
Okay. What you're going to see here is outside. This is what I think of as a broadband conference call. Just to get things going, hopefully. Do you see anything happening on the right?
Yeah.
Yes? No?
Yes, we do.
Oh, okay.
No?
Yes?
Sage.
Sage. Oh.
The other right.
He's there. I'm there. Yeah. He's the bunny. I'm Alice. Yeah.
There we go.
Okay.
I'm now moving way out here, and I see Alice here, and Alice is going to the mirror here. So if you look over here, you can see what I'm seeing. So I'm just following.
So what I'm looking at right now is a mirror, so I see myself and I see the bunny behind me. The mirror is essentially a portal, but it's a portal into the space we're in. It's actually, this is like a little 3D window. I can turn that around like that and again, resize it and pick it up and move it. It's probably the least interesting portal that you're going to see in just the next few minutes. Over here is our friend over there, but just to prove that looks are deceiving us. And then over here we have a little pyramid. Now what's happening is everything I do is shared over there with what he's doing. Essentially what we've got is a true shared space.
It's a replication architecture that's doing real-time transactions over the slow internet.
Right. And what's really cool about this is, in a sense, it's a late-binding protocol. All these objects have their own messages associated with them, but what happens, and they're all different. All objects have different capabilities and things that they do. But what's nice is that we don't really have to worry about a master protocol. Every object is different, but can then communicate to the rest of its peers to ensure that we're synchronized.
So it's rather, the front part is a little bit like the web in the sense that when you go somewhere that you don't have the stuff, it comes to you like a web page does. Unlike the web though, you don't just get a copy. You get a copy that's part of this massively parallel real-time transaction stuff so that when you do stuff to it's reflected in what you might call psychological real-time to everybody else. And people are interested in how that works. We'll explain it a little bit later.
Okay, now what I'm going to do is go into a true portal. This is our vision of Mars. And what's nice, remember this is a window, a door into that space, but I can actually move it around. Kind of like the mirror was, except I'm looking into another space. Well, we think of these as the links into another page, if you will, except it's live. And what I can do is literally drop into that space. In fact, if I turn around, I should be able to watch Alan come through.
Okay.
There he is.
One thing that's worth mentioning here is I am doing this part of the demo on, we try and use different machines as we go. This is an ultralight. This is a 2-pound machine that is doing my point of view on this system. Dave has got a little bit more of a gunboat kind of machine.
And mine okay. One has the problems. So this is a little robot that we've built. It's actually
going to get up on top of this rock so I can see you.
And what I'm going to do is start it going. And what's nice is I'm literally controlling both versions, and I can drive it around. Notice, by the way, I should point out one thing. This is all written in Smalltalk. We're using OpenGL at the bottom, but the rendering engine that I wrote is 100% Smalltalk or Squeak, which I find I was just totally impressed by what I could do. It allows you to think in a completely different and very powerful way. I didn't learn this, learn how to program Smalltalk until about a year and a half ago. So anyway, that's that, but it shows that a remote control of that object. Next, let's go to the flag world.
Okay, you go your way and I'll go my way.
Yeah. Here's another portal, and what I'm gonna do is go through this portal to yet another portal over here, and what we have is a little simulation running on top of that. Are you?
I'll close it.
Okay. And I'll watch you come down the stairs. This little escalator. This is actually a little tribute to Scott Fisher and Warren Robinette's work at NASA. Who that was, I don't know if you've ever seen that work, but that should be included in Alan's presentation.
It's too recent.
Yes. That was the 80s.
Okay.
Over here we have a little flag. I want to show you there. This is actually a mass spring simulation. It's not a pre-canned thing. And actually what I'm going to do is release the flag just to prove that. And then I'm going to crank it back. So really actually calculating the little masses and springs.
So it's like that particle system, except they're connected by springs and they're pulling fragments of the flag textures around.
So
I should give you a little spin, shouldn't I, David?
So what Alan's doing right now is I'm on a little carousel, and he just starts spinning it. Interestingly enough, we didn't program that explicitly. All that's happening is I happen to be on top of something that's moving, and whatever I happen to be on, I just sort of stick to, and he's changing it around someplace else, so it just works.
Okay.
All right, next up, we're going to go upstairs to a little underwater environment. This is our other collaborator, Andreas Robb, a brilliant hacker. Actually, he was the person who ported Squeak to the PC. And in here is a little underwater space. What's interesting, actually, Alan, when you come in, I'll watch you.
I should mention here that for people who follow the vivarium stuff that we did 15 years ago or so, this is the modern instantiation of it. So I'll come in, block, I turn it into
a fish. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is there's not enough fish, I'm going to create my own. So I need to grab a little paint package. And what I'm going to do is literally draw a little fish. Like so, give it a little bit of an eye, and a little bit of there, and then paint that, and then
what's going to happen here, by the way, is the work of Takeo Igarashi, who's now a professor at the University of Tokyo. He's done for his master's thesis, I think, and it's pretty darn cool. Go ahead.
What I just did, this is the fastest and easiest 3D design tool you ever saw in your life. Wow. Now, Alan's going to make something similar. He's going to add a little scene to it.
Yeah, so I should come over here. I'll do the same kind of thing. I'll go get a drawing tool here. And I'll do a much harder problem for this program, which is what do we call these things? Seaweed? Seaweed. So you imagine now the system is going to, basically what it has to do is it has to take these planar things that I'm painting and figure out the major and minor axes all over the thing regardless of what it is, and then use those as a way of spinning out the tiling for the thing. So this is, we'll have to think just a little bit here on this one. I couldn't actually believe that this would work. So of course I never even tried to do it. Wasn't it your kid?
Yeah.
Dave has a kid, so here it is.
And it's coming over here. Thing to notice also, everything we make is automatically copied over. So I've got, I'll grab this and move it around a little bit.
Actually, it's not really copied, it's actually recreated.
Right.
Because this is a replication architecture.
So what we've done, it's a shared, I said earlier, this is a collaborative environment. It's a broadband conference call.
All of these things are scriptable just the way I showed you. I'm not going to do that right now. But basically, it's all scriptable. And while you're in the routine, one thing I should do before we get out of there is just, this is kind of fun. Squeak has its own browsers. This may not look like a web browser, but we actually put the documentation for this stuff out on the web. And so I'm actually chugging through the actual documentation about how to draw your own fish here, which is sort of set up as a kind of bulletin
board. That's HTML.
That's HTML.
All right.
Okay, let's get out of here. We're doing well.
Yeah.
Almost done.
Number
two. Now we have to, let's see, let's close up that guy and then let's go into the David world.
That's me.
I'll close this guy. Oh, you
already did.
Okay, go ahead.
So this is another little world, just kind of show that we can do a little more
serious environments.
And it knows I'm following terrain. Ignore the texture glitches. What I'm going to do is go on top of that aqueduct. And
I'm just sitting up here so we can see Alice when she gets to the top. There she is.
So here I am. And
so the jump.
We will, but I think you should go all the way to the end and jump into the pool.
Okay. There's our. By the way, just one of the things about 3D spaces is. Virtual spaces is distance, so for me, I think that window over there is pretty far away. If I just give it a click, I'm right there. I got there really quickly. In fact, I'll jump out here. All these windows, if I step back, look like icons, and you can just jump to them. Anyway, just another nice, cool thing that, you know, once you start building these 3D environments and actually having something as powerful and useful as this, you have all kinds of things that emerge out of that. We finally have a system that's really good enough to do some really powerful experimentation. But, you can pick the windows up and carry them around with you. I guess that's it. That's about it.
So I'm going to, hang on. I want to put a little more context here. So let's see, number three.
Almost, we also have voice
communication. We're switching back. It's over there, but yeah, there's internet telephony. You have to have telephony in order to do real collaboration. You just have to be able to, because you're using your hands for doing stuff. Okay, so just two last things. One is that this is an interesting example of basically the Smalltalk that was last used at Xerox PARC, updated to the 21st century graphics and stuff. No intellectual interest whatsoever since about 1975, except that practically, pragmatically, it should be of some interest because, for instance, unlike Java, it runs exactly the same on every machine, identically, guaranteed by a porting mechanism we actually wrote up 20 years ago. Java didn't use it, and it's just simply not possible to implement something to a paper spec and validate it with benchmarks and have it run everywhere. You really have to generate the ports mathematically. Squeak is its own operating system. That's another thing. You don't try and use native tools. The exception here is the OpenGL stuff, but everything else is part of the graphics. The object system is kind of fun in that characters are actually objects. So this is kind of a little more of a sketchpad way of thinking about things. One of the things that's worthwhile showing is that there's no presentation application here, because if you have multiple desktops, and that's what we did have at Xerox PARC, then here are all the desktops that are part of my system here. Each one of them is a full unit of work, and I have a sorter for each talk that I give, so I can decide what to show next. Maybe I want to show this late binding slide next, and that just becomes part of the O'Reilly conference talk here. Why go to something weaker like PowerPoint to try and show stuff? This is an interesting example of what I consider to be a really negative, retrograde way of looking at things, which was the reemergence of applications and separate operating systems after I thought we'd safely killed them in the 70s. Sort of like using the wrong kind of wood for Dracula's steak. Key idea here, which is still not the main idea in this, is what to do until software engineering gets invented: do late binding. Virtually every piece of software done today is done as early binding through manipulating text files, compiling. Java still has a hard time adding code to itself while it's running, for Christ's sakes. So if we go back to Peter Deutsch's Lisp of 40 years ago, it did not have that problem. Should be able to do everything dynamically. The system should be able to safely maintain its own environment while you're debugging its own environment. Should be able to make every change in less than a quarter of a second, and so forth. And the reason is we just don't know how to do software yet. So basically, when you have the disaster, you finally realize, oh, I should have done this back here. If you've got a late binding system, you can go back and change it. If you've got a typical C-based, C++, Java, whatever other systems people use, you just can't do it. So this system is interesting in its antiquity of these late binding ideas. And we're showing that it can run just as fast as anybody's nervous system requires. And one last thing is, because it's a dynamic object system, all the objects are alive. So we can ask it questions as though it were a database. And the most interesting question, I think, at this point is, how large is the total code for the entire operating system and all the stuff that you've seen in bytes? I'll just ask it to count this right now and compute it. And the answer is 2.8 megabytes for everything. How many lines of code are there in the system? Well, the operating system and all the applications and everything, it's about 230,000 lines of code. Now, from our standpoint, we think it could be about 20,000 lines. So we're about a factor of 10 away from what we think the actual mathematical entropy of a system like this could be if you were doing the right things. We're going to take a shot at this 20,000 lines of code next year. And then the last thing is, how, since everything is an object in the system, we can ask it how many objects are there. Now it's counting all of the objects that it itself is using right now. There's about 1.8 million objects. So that's the end of our presentation, and thank you very much.